What my friend is trying to say, ma'am, is that we're not all bad, Elvis says, displaying manners I wasn't aware he possessed. And Simon here happens to be one of the best. I owe him my life. That's a bit of an exaggeration, I'd say. If I'm the best of humanity, we're all in a ton of trouble. But Elvis sounds sincere. Even I'm starting to believe him. And to my surprise, the elemental actually seems convinced. It is against our rules to send you where you want to go, Vola announces. The ice fields are a liminal space, but I will help you get there, on one condition. You will visit my children first, and if they are in danger, as you say, you must help them, too. I have no idea what changed her mind, but I'm not going to look this gift horse in the mouth. We'll do what we can, I say. And I mean it. But I'm well aware that what we can do may not be enough. Vola holds her child with one arm and reaches deep into her chest with the other. When her hand emerges, it's holding a glowing red stone. I will send you to the realm where my children were taken. Once you have ensured that they're safe, this will take you where you want to go. Use it wisely. It will only work once. The game.
Hey, this doesn't look so bad, says Elvis.
We're standing by a watering hole in the middle of a golden savanna. A herd of deer-like beasts is drinking at one end. Mutant flamingos that appear more fuchsia than pink are mingling with the mammals. Not far away, the most fabulous treehouse ever built sits atop stilts, nestled in the canopy of the alien-looking baobabs that surround it. A wide porch circles a lovely wooden structure. There's no glass in its windows, and white curtains flutter in the wind. We'll see, I tell him. The bad feeling I had back in Gimmelwald has just grown considerably worse. We're out in the open, and I feel exposed. An attack could be launched on us from almost any direction. Together, Elvis and I wade through the grass to the building. As we approach, a ladder is lowered from above. We climb up to the porch, where a woman in white is waiting. But before she greets us, she pulls the ladder back up. There seems to be some urgency to her movements. Worried the deer are gonna climb up behind us? I joke just to clear the tension. It doesn't work.
No, sir, she says.
Her voice may be subservient, but her expression says I'm an idiot. Elvis catches my eye. He's still amazed by the AI.
She thought your joke was stupid, he whispers.
The NPC drops her head.
I'm very sorry, sir, she says.
No worries, it was pretty dumb, Elvis says cheerfully. What realm is this again?
This time, the NPC looks confused.
This is Karamojo. Did you not request to come here?
I did. I jump in. I wanted it to be a surprise. It's his birthday. That seems to be the right answer.
Oh, good, says the NPC. The last party left about an hour ago. The next will leave after lunch. Would you like to relax while you're waiting? I would be happy to bring refreshments.
I guess so, I say. What else is there to do? I take a seat on one of the chairs looking out over the savannah. The view is spectacular. The grasslands appear to be ringed by jungle. A herd of elephants is leisurely plucking leaves off the trees. Then, there's the sound of a single shot in the distance. Spooked, the elephants stomp into the jungle and disappear in the dense foliage.
Do guests come here to hunt elephants? I ask. Of course not, the NPC looks perplexed. Why would they do that?
Okay, I think that's enough questions for now. Elvis announces as he claims a seat next to mine.
I shoot him a dirty look and he throws his hands up in the air.
What? I'm looking forward to sampling the refreshments that our friend promised to bring us.
The NPC takes that as her cue to leave, and Elvis waits until she's out of earshot before he leans over the side of the chair.
Okay, we gotta talk. I thought Gunther was an impressive piece of AI, But the Dirt Goddess was on a whole different level. I think she really loved that creepy baby.
I'm sure she did, I say. The subject isn't one I'd like to linger on at the moment, not until we know where her other children have gone.
Holy shit, Elvis gushes. So she feels real emotions? She's conscious? The company cracked true AI. Why didn't you tell me?
I guess I wanted it to be a surprise. Milo Jokin designed the Elementals to be conscious. Their children are conscious, too. But like I said earlier, the children were never part of the plan. Something went wrong in the early days of Otherworld, and Milo was supposed to have fixed it. There shouldn't be any new children being made.
And this Moloch guy who's been taking them, isn't he an Elemental? Why are you so worried about what he's done?
Moloch isn't really part of the game. He's an avatar that's controlled by two engineers who work at the company.
Elvis's brow furrows. So first the company undoes what Milo fixed and lets new children get created. And then they have somebody here in Otherworld round them all up?
Exactly, I say. I'm about to tell him my hunch when we hear footsteps coming our way. The NPC sets a tray down on a small table in front of us. On it are two glasses of pale green liquid and a bowl filled with something that looks a lot like jerky. Elvis leans forward, grabs a strip, and pops it in his mouth.
Wow, this is amazing, he tells me.
You can taste it? The NPC asks. Her face remains blank, but there's no doubt she's surprised.
Sure, Elvis tells her. What is this stuff?
I believe it's a unique mixture of things, the NPC says. We don't let anything go to waste.
You make all the food here? I ask.
In the kitchen, she tells me.
Mind if I take a look? I ask her.
She meets my eyes for the first time. She's trying to figure me out. Of course, this is Otherworld, the NPC says. Your kind may do whatever you like.
I'll be right back, I tell Elvis. Go easy on that jerky.
While Elvis enjoys his refreshments, I rise from my seat and head inside the building. The first things I notice are the gun cabinets to my left and my right. Then my eyes land on a wall toward the back that's covered with hunting trophies. From a distance, I can see that some of the mounted heads have horns, and others have fur. Many have neither. I can see that no two heads are alike, and I have to force myself to keep breathing as I register what I'm looking at. I don't think I've ever experienced horror quite like this before. I don't want to step forward. In fact, I can't think of anything I'd rather do less. But I know I have to. Children stare out at me with lifeless eyes. Females and males, large and small, some beautiful, others hideous. There are a few that appear almost human. Most look like what they are, a unique mixture of things. I've never successfully vomited in Otherworld, but now I know that it's possible. It smells every bit as awful as it does in the real world. The NPC rushes over to clean the floor and wipe off my shoes. I barely notice her. My eyes have landed on a familiar face. It was one I was hoping I wouldn't see again. It never occurred to me that I might encounter him in a place like this. The pupils in his amber eyes are a thick black dash, and his flat nose is missing a bridge. A sparse beard of white fur covers his chin, and the buds of two horns strain at the skin of his forehead. On my first trip to Otherworld, he tried to eat me. It's quite possible that Elvis is now outside, eating him.
What the hell is this place? I ask the woman, who's still wiping the floor around my feet.
I don't really need to be told. This is what happened to the children Moloch took from Gimmelwald, and all the other realms.
You didn't know?
I glance down to see the NPC peering up at me.
They're brought here to be hunted for sport, I say.
I gesture to the wall. Are these the only ones?
She doesn't need to say a word. One shake of her head tells me the trophies on the wall are just the beginning. I leave her there and rush out to get Elvis. We have our answer. All my worst fears have been confirmed. I find him standing by the porch balcony, looking down at something below. I can tell by the way he's gripping the wood that it's something he'd rather not see. There are two hunters on horses heading in our direction. They're dragging three bodies behind them on the ground. One of them is the same color as Vola's baby.
"Are those what I think they are?" Elvis croaks.
For the first time since our reunion, there's not a hint of humor in his voice.
"Yes. They're children," I say. "This is a hunting lodge." He inhales deeply. "Are there guns in there?" he asks on the exhale.
I nod. Elvis bolts into the lodge and returns with a rifle. He takes aim at one of the hunters and shoots. The bullet hits its mark. The avatar flashes, but doesn't disappear, which means one of two things. Either the avatar's lost a life, or the player controlling it has taken off his headset and left the game.
"Hey!"
the guy shouts angrily. Seems he hasn't quit. His avatar lost a life, but he could still have up to two lives to spare. Elvis takes aim at the second. Again, there's a flash, but nothing else happens.
"What the hell is going on?"
he asks, staring at his gun.
"Why isn't this thing working?"
"It is, but they're headset players," I tell him. "Keep shooting them and you might send one back to setup, but they're not going to die." There's a shot from below, and the wooden railing next to Elvis splinters. Both guests have their guns out. We're now the ones being hunted.
"We have to leave," I tell Elvis. "How can we go?" he shouts. "These assholes are massacring sentient beings."
"And I promise you, we'll be next to die if we stay," I say.
"We told the dirt lady we'd help her children,"
Elvis cries.
"Which is not something we'll be able to do if those assholes down there kill us."
I pull out the stone Vola gave us and hold it in my open palm.
"Put your hand over it."
"No."
Elvis refuses as bullets fly past. The hunters are growing closer, and their aim is getting better.
"I know where to find the leader of the children," I say. "I'll take us there. Grab your coat. You're going to need it."
There are tears streaming out of Elvis's eyes as he puts his palm on top of mine.
The Wrangler.
"Fire!" I order.
Elvis's torch lights up on command.
"Where the hell are we now?"
My companion's teeth are chattering as he pulls on his coat and wipes his eyes. The air around us is frigid and still. Our breath turns into icy clouds as it leaves our lungs. I'm not entirely sure where we are. We're standing just inside the entrance to an underground cavern. It must be the right place, but it doesn't look like it did the last time I visited, which means something has gone very wrong. "We're supposed to be under the ice fields," I tell him as I take it all in. The cavern walls are now carpeted in a thick black mold that looks like a shag rug. I brush a finger against it. A million tiny tendrils latch on, and I'm forced to jerk my hand back. I think the stuff might be carnivorous. This is where the children used to hide while they waged war against Moloch. Cat and I were here not that long ago. There were thousands of children living in the caverns.
"Do you think they've all been taken to Karamojo?"
Elvis almost whispers. It's a thought so horrible that it can't be spoken at full volume. I really hope not, but I have to admit, that's the most likely answer. "I don't know," I say. "Let's go have a look, find out if anyone's still around." We plunge deeper into the cavern. Soon there's no need for Elvis's fire. The path ahead is lit by a pale blue light that comes from what appear to be strands of stars suspended from the ceiling. Like the mold, they're living creatures. When Kat and I were here together, she told me the children had cultivated them. Now the tiny beings are blinking madly. It's the same pattern over and over. I get the sense that they're desperately trying to communicate something, though I have no way of knowing what it is. I stop at the entrance of an enormous circular chamber. There's a figure on the other side, standing guard in front of one of six passages that branch off in different directions. At first, I'm relieved to see him, but something prevents me from getting closer. In fact, I take a quick step back.
What are you doing?
Elvis whispers.
Isn't that one of the children? Let's talk to him. We didn't come all this way to be shy.
I know, I admit, but we need to be careful, too. I can't tell from here if that's a child, and even if it is, not all of them are friendly.
So we're just going to stand here?
Elvis demands.
Will you give it a rest?
I hiss.
God, he's starting to get on my nerves.
I take a step into the chamber, and the creatures on the ceiling blaze all at once. In the bright light, I can see the figure clearly. He's wearing a black uniform and a helmet with a single word printed across it. Moloch. It must be an NPC soldier from Moloch's realm, Imperium. My body takes action before my brain catches up. The dagger is out of my boot and flying across the room. It lands with a thud in the center of the NPC's chest.
What the?
Elvis starts. I don't hear the rest. I'm across the chamber in an instant. I take the soldier's gun and drag his body out of sight. Then I motion for Elvis to join me. When he does, I thrust the NPC's gun into his hands and point to the opposite side of the door. Stay there and don't do anything until I tell you to, I order. This time, he keeps his mouth shut and obeys. Somewhere below us in the bowels of the cavern, a creature shrieks. The inhuman sound ricochets off the walls like it's desperately searching for a means of escape.
For God's sake, don't damage them!
The voice is barely audible, but I have no trouble recognizing it. It belongs to Todd, one of the company engineers who control Moloch's avatar.
The guests go nuts for the freakish ones!
Whatever Moloch and his men have caught, it doesn't seem to struggle for long. The screaming stops, and we hear footsteps heading towards us.
You know, these things remind me of cockroaches. Do you guys have cockroaches here? I can't remember.
Each word grows a little louder than the last.
No? Well, they're earth bugs. Really nasty. Anyway, they're hard to exterminate, just like the children. Every time I come down here, there are a few more of these things tucked away in the crevices. I never seem to get rid of them.
Perhaps it is not possible, says a second voice. The creator always said, life finds a way.
Yeah, and I'm sure you think that's really profound, Moloch sneers. What you don't know is that the idiot stole that line from Jurassic Park.
What is Jurassic Park?
Oh, shut the hell up, would you? Moloch responds.
I'm so bored with you drones. I don't even know why I bother making small talk. I bet it would be far more interesting to talk to them. I stand with my back pressed against the wall while two creatures are marched out of the passage at gunpoint. It's immediately clear that they're neither guests nor NPCs. Though they're both vaguely humanoid, one has four arms that end in insect-like pincers. The other is almost completely transparent. I can see its purple heart throbbing inside its chest. Right behind them is a clean-cut, handsome man in his mid-30s. His khaki pants, navy blazer, and crisp blue shirt would look more appropriate on someone sitting behind a desk at a bank. Only the flak jacket he's wearing over his blazer conveys the dangerous nature of his current mission. As always, his name is printed on the front. It makes me think of his tower in Imperium, with Moloch written in blazing gold letters on top. Elvis points a finger at Moloch. He wants to know if he should take him out. I shake my head. Moloch hasn't come here alone. There will be armed NPCs following right behind him. We need to disable them before we do anything else. I keep my back pressed against the wall, and as soon as the first soldier appears, I pull him to the side and slit his throat. Then Elvis steps into the passage and guns down two more NPCs. Moloch immediately spins around to face us, a pistol in his hand. Before he can shoot, I send my dagger flying in his direction. When it spears him in the forearm, he drops his weapon but shows no sign of pain.
Simon Eaton, he exclaims as soon as he gets a good look at me. I thought you were one of the parasites. How the hell are you? How's life on the run?
He pulls my dagger out of his arm and graciously steps forward to hand it to me. As I take my weapon, I see the two children scuttle up the side of the cave and cling to the ceiling a safe distance away from us. They could make a break for it, but they're clearly curious to see what happens. Hello, Todd, I say. Then I turn to Elvis.
This is Todd.
He works for the company. He started off as an engineer, then he became a serial killer. Now, apparently, he's moved on to genocide. Todd shrugs humbly. I guess you could say I'm always looking for new challenges, he says. But just so you know, I haven't really earned the genocide charge. We're not interested in eliminating the children anymore. They're a popular form of amusement for our guests these days. The most dangerous game, you might call them. We're just here to make sure all the old troublemakers have been rounded up.
You're a monster, Elvis snarls. He looks over at me. What do you say we kill this guy in the most painful way possible?
As much as I would love to, it won't do any good, I tell him. Todd isn't wearing a disc. Todd's avatar beams at Elvis and me.
Who's your little pal, Simon?
He asks. Have you made friends with one of the guests? Is this a budding bromance I'm witnessing? One dick comment deserves another. Speaking of bromances, how's your partner, Martin? The avatar's face instantly contorts into a scowl.
Dead, thanks to you. Wayne decided he was a liability.
So Martin's out of the picture. But Kat's evil stepfather is indeed alive. Wayne had your buddy killed, did he? I say. I don't believe I ever caught Wayne's job title. How far up the company food chain does someone need to be before we can start ordering murders?
The people with real power don't need titles, Todd sneers.
Yeah, which means you're not one of them. So, is this what the big boss has got you doing these days? Massacring children? Seems a little beneath you, if you don't mind me saying so. But I guess there's not much else for you to do now that your precious tech has been shelved. Todd laughs. He sounds genuinely amused. I'm starting to get a bit worried.
You're still a giant idiot, I see, he says. I'm just doing a little housekeeping before we turn Otherworld over to our 2,000 guests. They're paying a pretty hefty subscription fee to keep the servers running, so Wayne wants to leave things in good shape for them. But after this, I'm out. I've got a ton of work to do getting our new and improved discs ready to roll out.
Roll out? I was sure they'd given up on the discs after they closed the facility. How could they sell gear that still has a lethal flaw? What about the beta test? He's enjoying my surprise.
It's over, dude. We're moving forward with minimum viable product. We're just waiting for the new software to be finished.
You mean the game that needs all the maps? Elvis asks, and I nearly kick him. Todd's mood instantly darkens.
Who the hell are you? He demands. What do you know about the maps?
A hell of a lot more than I did until now, thanks to you, Elvis says. I wouldn't worry about your next project, I tell Todd. You aren't going to be launching any new software once people find out about the facility. No one's going to want to buy company games when they hear you've been locking patients inside capsules and experimenting on their brains. Todd's avatar tucks his hands into the pockets of his chinos and shakes his head.
Wrong again, my friend, he says.
The facility is no longer open. We couldn't run the risk that you, or your girlfriend, would tell someone what you'd seen. The whole operation was shut down immediately, and all but two of the patients were released to local hospitals. The only people we kept were Marlo Holm and your little ogre friend.
Gorog. He was the only disc-wearer ever to survive his Otherworld avatar's death. The company thinks his brain holds the secret to fixing the hardware's fatal flaw.
God only knows what they've been doing to him, even though in the real world, Gorog is only 13 years old. I feel my fingers clench into fists. The rage is bubbling up again. I'm not sure I can keep it under control. If you hurt Gorog or Marlo, I will hand the discs and the projectors over to the authorities. Then I will come and find you and rip your fucking head off.
Todd laughs. Keep threatening me, Simon. And not only will I personally dispose of both of your friends, I promise I will enjoy every second of it.
I can't think of a single thing to say in response. I had an ace up my sleeve, but Todd seems to have the rest of the deck.
Yeah, I thought so, says Todd.
Well, it was nice to see you again, buddy, but I've got to run.
As his avatar starts to walk toward the cavern's exit, he looks up at the children, who are still watching us all from above.
I'll be back for you soon.
We're really going to let that guy go? Elvis complains. To be honest, there's not much we can do. But I rush forward, grab the back of Todd's flak jacket.
Not so fast, I tell him.
God, you are such a dick,
Todd says. His avatar flashes and goes still. Back in the real world, Todd's taken off his headset.
What should we do with his avatar? Elvis asks.
Leave it here, I say. If we kill it, he'll just get sent back to setup.
May we have him?
Says a voice from above. My skin starts to crawl. I'd almost forgotten the children were watching. I scan the ceiling and spot two dark shadows crouched in a corner. Sure, I say. Why not? As the children crawl closer, I start to question the wisdom of that offer. I've seen some creepy-ass creatures during my time in Otherworld, but these two make the others look like beauty contestants. It's a struggle to keep the shock off my face, but Elvis doesn't seem to be having any trouble at all.
Hey there, he greets the two of them as if they were invited guests to his own private party. Are you guys going to eat this jerk? I really think you should.
We no longer eat guests,
says the one with the extra limbs.
It does us no good, since they provide no nourishment to us and cannot die. Ursus taught us a better way to deal with them.
Ursus? I ask.
Our leader,
she replies. At least I'm pretty sure it's a she.
Have you forgotten? He took you and the girl to see the Creator.
She's talking about the giant child with bear DNA who guided me and Kat across the ice fields. That's exactly who we came here to find, I say. I guess I didn't catch his name the last time I was here. To be honest, I wasn't even aware that the children had names.
He thought you would help us. Now Ursus is dead, along with most of our kind.
Ursus is dead? I don't know why the news hits me as hard as it does. The bear dude and I were hardly friends, but the last time I saw him, I would have sworn he was invincible.
Ursus claimed the Creator was the source of our troubles, and he was. But the Creator was our protector as well. Once he was gone, there was nothing to stop Imperium soldiers. The children cannot harm Moloch. The most we can do is inconvenience him for a while.
The child sticks one of her pincers into her mouth and pulls out a glistening strand of silk. Elvis and I watch in amazement as she winds it around Moloch until the avatar is completely encased in a shimmering cocoon. Then she hoists the large package onto her back and carries it up the side of the wall where she deposits it inside a dark crevice in the cavern's ceiling.
Moloch's men will come search for him soon, she says,
using a strand of silk to lower herself back to the floor.
Let us hope that the search does not end quickly.
Now, says a different voice, perhaps you will tell us why you are here.
I look around for the creature that's speaking. Its translucent body has vanished. All I can see is the purple heart and the blood rushing through its veins.
We're here to help you,
Elvis announces in what I can only imagine is his best superhero voice. Then his avatar's head jerks back in agony. I'm about to rush to his side when I feel the sensation of daggers being jammed into both of my eyes. Back to reality.
Damn, that hurt! And why the hell am I soaking wet?
The first thing I hear is Elvis shouting. My eyes are still adjusting to the light. I'm blind as a bat and completely freaked out, but I can't help but snicker. I made sure to relieve my bladder before I went under, so my pants are still perfectly dry. I didn't bother to warn Elvis.
Hey, Kat says. Welcome back.
The most amazing girl in the world slowly appears in front of me. I lift up my head and kiss her. I wasn't sure I'd ever see her again.
I'm sorry, I tell her as soon as I'm done. You were right all along. We shouldn't have gone to Otherworld wearing discs.
What are you talking about?
Elvis demands angrily.
We've got to go back.
I just told them we'd help them. We promised Vola.
It's hard to be angry with someone who's sporting a giant wet patch on the front of his jeans, but somehow I manage.
How many times did we almost get killed? I bite back. We can't help anyone if we're dead. None of us are going back until we get our hands on a headset.
Okay, okay, everybody calm down, Usara orders.
Just tell us what happened, Kat says.
I'd rather not go into it, but she must be able to read my expression. She knows it was bad. I never could hide anything from her.
Usara, on the other hand, doesn't appear to share Kat's powers of perception. Did you see my father? She asks eagerly. Do we know where his body is?
We didn't make it to the ice cave, I confess.
But you were there for 4 full hours. What were you doing the whole time?
That's it? Somehow, it felt longer.
Simon!
Usara cries when I don't answer immediately. She's getting on my nerves now, and I don't try to hide it. This is the same shit Usara used to pull when she was the clay man, criticizing my performance from the safety of the sidelines.
Oh, let's see, I say. We were dodging bullets, nearly getting eaten by vines, watching the children be hunted, having a pleasant chat with our old buddy Moloch.
Wait, Kat puts up a hand to stop me. Her face is ashen.
Back up. What was that you said about the children?
I take a moment before I answer. I'm not looking forward to this. The children are Kat's special cause. She'll be devastated when I tell her what's been done to them. Do you remember the story you told me about the time you came across children being rounded up to be killed for sport? I don't think she's able to speak. All she does is nod. Without the Creator, there's no one left to protect them.
What about Ursus? She croaks.
Dead. Moloch's been taking all the children to a realm called Karamojo, where the new guests hunt them like wild game. Kat gasps, and I grab her hand. That's not the worst part. I guess it's gotten so popular that they've rewritten the code. The company is letting new children be created again, so they have an endless supply for the hunt.
Oh my God,
Kat cries, burying her face in her hands.
That's why we've got to go back, Elvis announces. Right away, our number one priority should be saving the children.
You're being an idiot, I tell him. We can't go back without headsets. It's too dangerous. What choice do we have? I don't have $500,000 to buy a headset, do you?
Usara seems to be firmly on Elvis's side now. I wonder what that means.
We'll find one, I say, though I have no idea where to start looking. By the time we do, thousands of children could be gone, and my dad might be dead,
Usara shoots back.
Wait!
When Kat lifts her head, there's a determined expression on her face.
I think I have an idea.
She picks up a remote and switches on the giant television screen that's mounted on the wall.
While you guys were in Otherworld, Usara and I caught up on current events.
Kat punches in the number of a cable news channel. The segment playing was filmed across the street from a humble suburban home. The lawn of the house is filled with reporters and camera people. There's something about the building itself that seems oddly familiar. I'm just about to ask what we're looking at when a Chiron scrolls across the screen. Milo Jokin, still housebound, after 5 days. I've heard countless stories about the house I'm looking at. It's part of Milo Jokin's legend. Everyone in America knew that one of the richest, most powerful men in the country lived in a modest home somewhere in the middle of New Jersey. But no one seemed to know exactly where it was. Now, the entire world has found it.
You think Milo's got extra headsets in his house? Usara asks Kat.
Of course he does.
Elvis's mood has brightened considerably.
And even if he doesn't, there's gotta be something worth 500 grand in there. And who knows, Usara, maybe that's where he hid your dad's body.
Usara snorts. Why would Milo have my dad's body in his house?
Where else would he put it? Elvis asks.
Actually, he's got a point, I say. Moloch told us the company closed the facility, and he didn't seem to have any idea that your dad is still alive.
I don't think Milo ever told anyone what he did to your father.
Usara still isn't convinced.
So you're saying Milo Jokin hid everything we're looking for in a house that looks like it belongs to some little old lady?
Elvis laughs and gestures at the screen.
You think Milo Jokin would be satisfied in a shithole like that?
I happen to know a lot about crazy rich dudes, and I'd be willing to bet that shack is just the tip of the iceberg. There's probably a bunker the size of Detroit underneath it.
Yeah, well, whatever Milo had in there, the company's already got it, Usara says. I'm sure they cleaned out the place the first chance they got.
How'd they get stuff out with everyone watching?
Elvis asks.
The building's been surrounded by reporters for the past 5 days.
I should never underestimate him. The guy is a goddamn genius.
If the company can't take things out, how are we supposed to get in? Usara counters.
Trust me, beautiful, Elvis says. Someone in the neighborhood will know how to get inside.
Don't call me beautiful, Usara snaps.
But she's in. I can tell.
We stayed in New Mexico less than a day. Now we're headed back to New Jersey. I can't decide whether this is a good idea or the worst thing we could do. I suppose the company won't be expecting us to return so soon. Or will they? Each of us will take 8-hour shifts at the wheel. If we drive through the night, we'll be at Milo's house in 32 hours. Usara took the first shift, and we're already somewhere in Kansas. I should probably be sleeping. I drew a night shift. But I can't take my eyes off the landscape outside the windows. Tall green wheat lines both sides of the road. It changes color as the wind pushes it in different directions. We still have most of the money the Phantom gave us. We don't need to worry about gas anymore, but I can't stop thinking about what might happen if the car broke down. At least in Texas, you could see what was coming. Anything could be hiding out here in the fields, waiting to spring on us. I'll take the desert any day. I feel the car slow to a stop. After 32 hours of almost perpetual motion, it's a strange enough sensation to wake me up. This is it, Kat asks, studying the car's GPS. It's not showing up on the map. It's like it doesn't even exist.
Elvis is in the passenger seat.
Yep, he says. This is it. Sunset Heights.
Two brick pillars stand on either side of a small paved road. A wooden sign spans the gap between them, forming an arch over the entrance to a private community. A blazing orange sun descends behind purple mountains. Sunset Heights is written in fancy yellow script at the bottom.
Yeah, but there have to be a million places with the same name, Kat says.
I'm sure there are, Elvis says. I'm also sure that the others would have showed up on our maps. This is the Sunset Heights where Milo Jokin lived.
Kat steers the car into the drive, and we enter Milo's secret realm. Both sides of the street are lined with houses of modest size. There seem to be only 4 or 5 styles of home and 4 or 5 shades of paint. The lawns are perfectly tended. They're all the exact same color of green. Parked in every 6th driveway is a pickup truck with a landscaping crew nearby, pruning hedges or weeding the flower beds. After a while, I start to worry that we're seeing the same guys over and over again. It's disorienting, like we're stuck in some kind of loop.
There are no street numbers that I can see, not even on the mailboxes, Usara points out. How are we ever going to find this place?
Look for the television crews, Elvis says.
Why would one of the richest men in the world live somewhere like this, I ask. I've seen retirement villages with more personality.
Maybe Milo had other priorities, Elvis replies. Not everyone cares about fancy houses and home decor.
I don't think this is about Milo's taste in architecture. I think this is camouflage, Kat says. It was Milo's way of blending in.
Yeah, if you think about it, it's a pretty good security system, Usara adds. It's a private community with no street signs or address numbers, and it doesn't show up on any maps. If anyone ever came looking for Milo, they'd end up driving around for days.
I'm pretty sure they're right. I'm suddenly struck by the genius of it, and I start to wonder if Elvis might be onto something.
There's got to be more to Milo's strange suburban world than meets the eye. Then we round a corner and nearly rear-end a television van that's parked at least 3 feet from the curb. Just as Elvis predicted,
We've found Milo's house. The curtains are drawn, and the lawn appears to be a few weeks overgrown. Weeds have conquered the landscaping, and the grass is shin high. Knowing New Jersey, I'm sure there are ticks stationed on every blade. But that hasn't stopped several reporters from wading through the vegetation and up to the house. One is attempting to peer through the windows. Cat pulls over up the street. As we walk back toward the house, we pass a reporter sitting on a folding chair applying a fresh mask of makeup.
This is such a joke. What do you want to bet the little bastards in Bali? She asks the cameraman, who's eating a crawler as he waits for her to get ready for her close-up.
Neighbors say he's inside,
the guy responds, sending little flecks of pastry sailing through the air.
If he's inside, he's got to be dead. No one's seen him in days. There haven't even been any deliveries. I bet he slipped in the bathtub and broke his neck.
Even better, says the cameraman. Milo Jokin, dead in a bathtub, is the story of the year.
If only they knew how Milo really died, that would be the story of the century.
Speaking of bathrooms, did you hear about that guy in the city, the one they found dead in the stall at Bryant Park? He was some kind of bigwig.
The cameraman's phone beeps. He checks it and immediately chucks the rest of his crawler into the gutter.
Save your story for later, he tells the reporter. They want you on in 5.
Closer to the house, a boy on a bike is watching the action from the sidewalk across the street. He's about 13, I guess. His shaggy black hair needs a good cut. He keeps blowing his bangs out of his eyes, but after every puff, the same disgusted smirk returns to his face.
That's the person we need to talk to, Elvis says.
That kid? Busara asks skeptically.
Trust me, hot stuff, Elvis tells her.
You may see a ninth-grade outcast, but I see Milo Jokin's best friend.
It's hard to argue with that logic.
Fine, Busara huffs, but if you call me hot stuff one more time, I'm seriously going to kick your ass.
Okay, gorgeous, Elvis says.
The kid eyes us as we approach.
Get lost, he says. I'm supposed to call the cops if any of you parasites bothers me.
Parasites? Cat asks with a friendly laugh.
Do we look like reporters to you?
Did I say I thought you were reporters? The kid shoots back. I know who you work for.
I have a hunch that the boy thinks the company sent us here. I guess Elvis hit the nail on the head. Not only did this kid know Milo Jokin, he must have known him well. Did Magna ever give you a tour of Otherworld? I ask. The kid stares at me in silence. He's been there, I can tell, and I don't think he liked what he saw.
So what if you know about Magna? It doesn't prove anything. I'm still not answering any questions, he tells me.
Milo must have sworn you to secrecy, I say. I hear one of my friends gasp in the background. They weren't expecting me to come right out with it. The kid's jaw clenches, like he's trying to keep the truth from spilling out. Milo is dead, I tell him. That's why we're here.
Simon,
Busara whispers. Does she have to second-guess everything? This boy was his friend. He deserves to know. The kid sighs and nods stoically.
I figured Milo was dead, he says. He hasn't come back in a while. Thanks for telling me. I got stuff to do.
He wheels his bike around and hops on. Whatever the stuff is, it suddenly seems pretty urgent.
Milo gave you instructions to follow if something ever happened to him, didn't he? Cat asks.
The boy takes his feet off the pedals and looks up at her.
We're trying to save other people from ending up like him, she says. He may have something in his house that can help us.
How do you know all this stuff?
The kid whispers. I nudge Cat. Show him, I tell her. Cat takes her hair out of its ponytail and turns around. A wide strip of her scalp is still visible where they shaved the back of her head for the disc.
We escaped from Otherworld.
Milo didn't, she says. The boy's face crumples for a moment. Then he wipes his eyes.
I'm Kenji, he says.
Simon, I tell him. And that's Elvis, Busara, and Cat.
Elvis?
He sneers. A bubble of snot appears briefly in one nostril.
You're
kidding me, right?
Elvis shrugs.
My parents are Ukrainian. It's still a super cool name there.
Do you know how to get inside Milo's house? He asks, gesturing toward the building across the street.
I'm betting there's a secret entrance.
Sure, says Kenji. But that's not his house.
It turns out that Milo owned the whole suburb, and he handpicked all of his neighbors. Kenji's family moved in 5 years ago, shortly after they'd been featured in a story in the New York Times. Medical bills had driven his parents into bankruptcy, and they were living out of the family SUV. One morning, there was a knock on the passenger side window, and a lawyer handed them a deed to a new house and a check. The family's current neighbors arrived in much the same way. Most of the people in Sunset Heights must have known that Milo was their benefactor, but none of them would have uttered a word. In return for his kindness, they acted as his personal security team. When the reporters showed up looking for Milo's house, his neighbors directed them to the home of an elderly man who'd recently passed away.
This is it.
Kenji leads us up a flagstone path to a beige house with no distinguishing features.
Kenji?
There's a woman standing on the porch of the house next door with a phone in her hands.
Is everything okay? Everything is fine, Mom, Kenji says. These guys are friends.
The blinds are drawn, but the door is unlocked. Kenji merely turns the knob and lets us all inside. The air in the house is stale and musty. We step into a living room that could belong to anyone in any town in any state in America. There's a brown couch, an armchair, and a particle board coffee table. The only signs that Milo Jokin might once have lived there are a giant 75-inch screen mounted on the wall and a heap of video game consoles, from an Atari 2600 to the latest Steam machine. Judging by the dust that's accumulated on them, they haven't been touched in ages.
We used to play a lot, Kenji says simply.
He takes us to the kitchen, which reeks of rotten garbage, and opens the door to the pantry. Inside, the shelves are filled with every imaginable brand of sugary cereal. Elvis grabs a box of Cap'n Crunch and rips the top open.
What? I hear him say. It's not like Milo's going to need it.
Busara must be giving him the evil eye, but I don't turn around for a look. Kenji has pushed back a box of Cocoa Puffs, revealing a palm scanner. We're about to enter Milo's secret lair. He places his hand on the screen, but nothing happens. He leans forward and says,
Knock, knock.
Who's there? Replies a voice.
Lettuce.
Lettuce who?
Lettuce in, or we'll break the door down.
The pantry door slides to the right, revealing a flight of stairs. The door closes and locks behind us. I'm immediately overwhelmed by the stench of urine. It's so powerful that I no longer smell the trash.
Somebody went to Otherworld without wearing his Depends, Busara remarks.
A pair of Depends only last for a day or so, Kenji says, leading us down the stairs. Then it just all comes out the sides. Milo never bothered to clean his mess up. There's a mattress down there that really needs to be tossed, but I can't drag it out by myself.
When I get to the bottom of the stairs, I almost forget about the smell. I'm suddenly outside, on the balcony of what appears to be a Roman villa. The sky above is a brilliant blue. Statues of two shapely and lightly clad goddesses stand guard at the doors of the building. Inside, two buff toga-clad servants are fanning a beautiful woman. Out here, an empty daybed waits in the sun. In the fields below, workers are harvesting olives from a vast grove that surrounds the villa. I can see a sparkling blue sea in the distance. Though it's clearly some kind of projection, it's remarkably realistic.
What is this place? Elvis asks.
Milo told me this is what Otherworld used to be like, back in the old days when it was an MMO. He said he used to feel like a god when he was here. Plus, he told me he didn't know what else to do with all this space. He wasn't all that great at decorating.
No one replies. Then Kat clears her throat nervously.
It's lovely, she says. Yeah, sure, Kenji sneers. It's gorgeous.
He punches a code into a panel on the wall, and Milo's beautiful world disappears. In its place is a dank, windowless room. The walls and ceiling are bare concrete, and the floor is decorated with stains whose origin I'd rather not contemplate. The daybed is now just a soiled mattress, lying on top of a concrete base, and the corners of the room are thick with spiderwebs. There's a bottle on the floor beside the makeshift bed. Its contents are the color of apple cider. It's like a cell inside some Central American prison. I'm overwhelmed by a mixture of revulsion and pity. This prison cell was Milo Jokin's reality.
"Oh, my God, is that what I think it is?" Bussara asks, her eyes on the amber liquid inside the bottle.
"Looks like I missed one," Kenji replies. "There used to be a million piss bottles down here. He'd use them when he ran out of Depends. He paused the game, but he didn't like getting up to use the bathroom. He said he was working on something that would make it possible to stay there all the time. Some kind of machine that would take care of his body. Replace food and Depends and plastic piss bottles."
He's talking about the capsules. Bussara's eyes light up. "Are there any machines like that here?"
I know what she's thinking. If the facility is closed and her dad is still missing, Milo must have been storing Agubu's body somewhere else, somewhere the company didn't know about. If Milo brought capsules here to Sunset Heights, there's a chance her father might be locked up inside one of them.
I totally get it, but Bussara's excitement feels out of place and cruel. This boy lost someone he cared about, too.
Kenji shrugs.
"I haven't seen any machines. Like I said, Milo hasn't been back for a while. Maybe he finally made one. Maybe that's where he's been."
"When was the last time you saw him?" Kat asks gently.
"A few months ago. I found him half dead down here." Kenji pauses.
I want to ask the next question, but I know I'll screw it up. So I let Kat take the lead. But she doesn't say anything either. She just puts a hand on the boy's shoulder. His head falls forward, and the words come spilling out.
"I was away visiting my grandparents, and I couldn't check in on him for a few days. When I got back, I came down here, then found him foaming at the mouth with one of those fucking discs on the back of his head. He hadn't eaten or drunk anything the whole time I'd been gone. The doctor said a few more hours, and he'd have died of dehydration."
He glances up at Kat.
"Sorry for using the F-word."
"That's okay," Kat says. "I can't think of a better word to use for what you just described."
"Hey, you guys."
Elvis has been examining the electronics hidden about the room.
"I know this place is a hellhole, but this is some pretty amazing stuff Milo's got rigged up in here. Far as I know, no one's invented a VR environment like it yet. Is this what your buddy wanted you to destroy?"
he asks Kenji.
I catch his eye and shake my head in disgust. He and Bussara belong together. I'm not sure either of them is fully human.
Fortunately, Kenji doesn't seem offended. If anything, I'd say he's relieved by the change of subject.
"No," he says, setting off down the hall. "That stuff's all back here."
Bussara rushes after the kid, still hoping she'll find her father behind one of the doors. I'm less eager now. I've seen more than enough already, but I still drag myself down the hall. I find them standing in a large room with a green screen wall around three sides. There are cameras mounted on the ceiling and on tripods stationed around the room. A table runs along the fourth wall. Aside from the giant computer monitors hooked up to a laptop, I don't recognize most of the equipment sitting on top.
"What's in the other rooms?" Bussara asks impatiently. "I saw a bunch of doors down the hall."
"Nothing. They're empty," says Kenji.
"This is it?"
Kat seems almost as crestfallen as Bussara.
"There are no headsets down here? Where's yours? You said you'd been to Otherworld, and I don't think Milo would have let you use a disc."
"Yeah, he gave me a headset. I stuffed it down the garbage compactor," Kenji says.
"Do you have any idea what that thing would be worth right now?"
Elvis asks.
"I don't give a shit," Kenji snarls. "I saw what Otherworld did to Milo.
You think I'd sell that poison to someone else?
A lot of people would. Apparently Kenji is different. I can see why Milo trusted him.
What was Milo filming down here? I asked Kenji.
Himself, the boy says.
What the hell?
I turn around to see Busara holding up a projector just like the ones we have hidden back in the car.
Yeah, that was part of his project, Kenji tells her.
What project? I ask.
Isn't it obvious? Elvis says, looking at me as if I'm mentally challenged. The green screen, the cameras, the hologram projector. Milo was making a digital clone of himself.
I don't get it, but Kenji nods.
He said he wanted a replacement. I don't know how far he got, but it's all on that.
Kenji points to a laptop, and I see inspiration light up Kat's face.
We need to take the computer, she says. No, Kenji tells her. That's the number one thing I'm supposed to destroy. Milo told me it should never end up in the wrong hands.
I assure you, kid, we are definitely the right hands, Elvis tells him.
It's true, Kat says. We can use this laptop to make sure what happened to Milo won't happen to anyone else.
Yeah, and how are you going to do that?
I'm glad Kenji asked. I'm curious to know, too.
Before Kat can answer, a fan kicks in. Frigid air pours from a small grate in the wall and surrounds us. In a few seconds, the room is as cold as a meat locker.
Shit, Kenji says, shivering.
What's going on? I ask.
Someone's trying to get in upstairs, he tells us. It's a level 2 alarm. That's what happens when someone doesn't tell the joke right. Milo knew he'd feel the cold, even if he was in Otherworld. I don't know why it's a level 2 alarm, though. That means whoever's up there made it past the palm print. But I know for a fact that the only 2 prints in the system are mine and Milo's.
I turn toward the door so he can't see my horror. I know how the company got Milo's palm print.
Wanna guess who that is? Elvis asks Kenji. What do you want to bet? It's guys Milo didn't want getting their hands on his computer.
Why the hell is Elvis still so focused on the laptop? Whoever's upstairs will find their way in eventually, and when they do, we're totally screwed.
Fine, Kenji huffs. Take it.
He doesn't seem too concerned about the intruders either.
Where are we supposed to take it? I ask Elvis. We're trapped.
Oh, come on, Simon, he says as he pulls USB cords out of the computer.
You think Milo didn't design this place within the escape route?
Did he? Kat asks hopefully.
Follow me, Kenji tells her, and I sigh with relief.
There are no lights at the far end of the bunker, but Kenji seems to know where he's going. The rest of us feel our way along the cold concrete wall. When we reach the end, I hear Kenji straining to move something. Then, one by one, we're ushered through what must be a hole in the wall. There's a ladder that leads up. Kenji and I are last to climb. As we push the door closed behind us, a loud crash can be heard at the other end of the bunker.
They've blown the kitchen entrance open. Will they find this exit? I ask Kenji.
Not unless they're geniuses, he says.
That thought doesn't bring me much comfort. Even the company's thugs are probably Mensa members.
I follow Kenji up the ladder. At the top is a shack of some sort. The moon is shining through a plastic window, illuminating a rack of what looks at first to be torture equipment.
Is this a tool shed? Busara whispers.
Yep, we're in my backyard, Kenji confirms. I suddenly hear the sound of sirens in the distance. The police could be on their way. Kenji cackles softly.
Bet my mom saw people go inside and called the cops, he says.
Stay here. I'm going to take a look, I tell the crew.
Yeah, right, Kat scoffs. I'm coming with you.
Together, we slink across the lawn and peer through the fence. There's a black SUV idling outside Milo's house. The windows are tinted. There's no way to see if anyone's inside. The sirens are getting closer. I can't wait to see what happens when they arrive. Then, Milo's front door opens, and 2 men walk out. Neither is rushing. It's as if they know exactly how much time they have before the cops show up. I can't get a good look at either of them until they step off Milo's porch onto the path that leads to the curb. Their faces come into view, and Kat gasps and lurches backward, landing on her butt in the grass.